readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, a poli-sci major in college and a lifelong political enthusiast. Who isn't talking about politics right now? Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Florida. Though the weather across the country is sub-zero, presidential campaigning is heating up. I'm fascinated by the caucuses, the primaries, the candidates. So, as your host, I present you with an issue not open to debate. There is a fascinating new crop of books on this subject and about many of the players. Let's see how many of these titles you'll support as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need MagicBuzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The MagicBuzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. MagicBuzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz. We're there when you can't be.
In 2008, the presidential election became blockbuster entertainment. Everyone watched as the race for the White House unfolded like something from the realm of fiction. The meteoric rise and historic triumph of Barack Obama, the fall of the House of Clinton, and Hillary's improbable resurrection as America's face to the world. The performance of John McCain and the puzzling emergence of Sarah Palin. But despite the wall-to-wall media coverage, remarkably little of the story behind the headlines has been told. In Game Change, Obama and the Clintons, McCain and Palin, and the Race of a Lifetime, John Heilman and Mark Halpern, two of the country's leading political reporters, used their unrivaled access to pull back the curtains on the campaigns. How did Obama convince himself that, despite the thinness of his resume, he could become the nation's first African-American president? How did the tumultuous relationship between the Clintons shape and warp Hillary's supposedly unstoppable bid? What was behind her husband's furious outbursts and devastating political miscalculations? And why did McCain make the novice governor of Alaska his running mate? Was Palin merely painfully out of her depth, or just a pain? Game Change answers those questions and more. Dennis Boutsakaris narrates.
How did Obama, a freshman senator with few tangible political accomplishments, convince himself that he should be and could be America's first African-American president? What role did Bill Clinton actually play in his wife's campaign? Why did McCain pick the unknown and untested governor of Alaska as his running mate? And who is Sarah Palin, really? Although no work of this kind, lacking the distance and perspective of time, can hope to be definitive, we are convinced that some answers are more readily discovered in the ground that lies between history and journalism, precisely the spot that we are aiming for and believe this audiobook occupies. Prologue. Barack Obama jerked bolt upright in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. Darkness enveloped his low-rent room at the Des Moines Hampton Inn. The airport across the street was quiet in the hours before dawn. It was very late December 2007, a few days ahead of the Iowa caucuses. Obama had been sprinting flat out for president for nearly a year. Through all the nights he'd endured in cookie-cutter hotels during the months of uncertainty and angst, months of lagging by a mile in the national polls, his improbable bid for the White House written off by the Washington Smart Set, his self-confidence shaken by his uneven performance, and the formidability of his arch-rival Hillary Clinton, Obama always slept soundly, like the dead. But now he found himself wide awake, heart pounding, consumed by a thought at once electric and daunting. I might win this thing. The past months in Iowa had been a blur of high school gyms, union halls, and snow-dusted cornfields. Obama was surging. He could sense it. The crowd swelling, the enthusiasm mounting, his organization clicking, his stump speech catching sparks. His strategy from day one had been crystalline: win Iowa and watch the dominoes fall. If he carried the caucuses, New Hampshire and South Carolina would be his, and so on, and so on. But as Obama sat there in the pre-dawn stillness, the implications of the events that he saw unfolding hit him as never before. He didn't feel ecstatic. He didn't feel relieved. He felt like the dog that caught the bus. What was he supposed to do now? By the morning of the caucuses, Obama was laboring to project his customary aura of calm. Never too high, never too low was how he and everyone else described his temperament. His opponents were still out there running around, squeezing in a few last appearances before the voting started, but Obama had decided to chill. He woke up late, played some basketball, went for a haircut with Marty Nesbitt, a pal of his from Chicago. Lazing around the hotel afterward, he and Nesbitt shot the breeze about sports, their kids, and then more sports. Anything, that is, to avoid talking about the election, the one topic that Obama seemed intent on banishing from his head. The phone rang. Obama picked it up. Chris Edley was on the line. The two men had known each other for almost 20 years, since Obama was a student at Harvard Law School and Edley one of his professors. Now the dean of Bolt Hall at Berkeley, Edley was one of the few outsiders in whom Obama had confided all year long, with whom he shared his frustrations and anxieties about his campaign, which were greater than almost anyone knew. But today it was the teacher who was stressing while the pupil played Mr. Cool. "I haven't been able to eat in 36 hours. I'm so nervous," Edley said. "How are you doing?" "I'm serene," Obama said. "I just got back from playing basketball." "You've got to be kidding." "Nope," Obama said. "We had a strategy. We stuck to it. We executed it reasonably well. Now it's in the hands of the voters." Obama's advisors took comfort in his serenity, but share it they did not. The Obama Brain Trust, David Axelrod, the hangdog chief strategist and self-styled keeper of the message, David Plouffe, the tightly wound campaign manager, Robert Gibbs, the sturdy, sharp-elbowed Alabaman communications director, Steve Hildebrand, the renowned field operative behind the campaign's grassroots effort in Iowa, was a worrywartish crew by nature, but their nerves were especially jangly now, and with good reason. The Obamans had bet everything on Iowa. If their man lost, he was probably toast, and certainly so if he placed behind Clinton.
That was Game Change by John Heilemann and Mark Halperin. A veteran newsman, Jim Lehrer has presided over 11 presidential debates. His new book, Tension City, Inside the Presidential Debates, From Kennedy-Nixon to Obama-McCain, offers readers a revealing look at more than 40 years of televised political debate in America. Born in Kansas, Lehrer received a journalism degree from the University of Missouri before joining the Marines. From 59 to 66, he was a reporter for the Dallas Morning News and the Dallas Times-Herald. His newspaper career led him to public TV. He moved to Washington to serve as the public affairs coordinator for PBS and then to the National Public Affairs Center for Television. This led to his association with Robert McNeil and to their long-term partnership. Lehrer has received numerous awards, including two Emmys and the George Foster Peabody Broadcast Award. He is the author of 20 novels, two memoirs, and three plays. Welcome, Jim. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Oh, the pleasure's mine, Elaine. Thank you.
How did you choose Tension City as the title of this book?
Well, there's a backstory to it. I worked on the book 2.5 or 3 years, and from day one, when I first came across the empty computer screen to start, I had the title. I wrote the title, Moderator, by Jimmy Charles, whatever. And for 2.5, 3 years I worked on the book, it was always called Moderator. And then once the book was done, it was ready to go to print, more or less, my editor at Random House called me and said, "Oh, Jim, we've been talking," which is a little scary because I know who we is. And I said, "What have you been talking about?" "Well, we don't think the title is really that great." And I said, "Well, that's too bad because the title is Moderator." And he said, "Okay, don't get too defensive on me." He said, "Just think of one, let me ask you one question." And I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, the question is, would you buy a book if with the title Moderator?" And I said, "Oh, okay, all right. I'll give it some thought." And I remembered one of the great privileges I had in addition to moderating presidential debates was I've had, over a period of 20 years, I did one-on-one interviews with just about all of the people who participated in these debates as candidates, either for president or for vice president, about their debate experiences. And I remembered, after I got that call, something that George H.W. Bush had told me when I asked him about the debates. He said, I asked him some hard-hitting question like, "Well, what were they like?" Something like that. And he said, those high-tension things, Jim, they are Tension City. And I remembered that, so I called Random House, and I said, "How about Tension City?" And he said, "Oh, you got it. So that's where it came from. And once I had realized, once that deal was made, I realized how appropriate it is, because everybody involved in these presidential, vice presidential debates is in some kind of Tension City format or mode. The candidates, the moderator, the people who are doing the lights, the people who are doing the sound, the people who are doing the seating, everybody involved is at some level of tension.
You wrote that George H.W. Bush felt that the debates were contrived, that the candidates were prompted, that there was an artificiality to it. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I mean, he said a lot of things, and he just hated those debates, and he said it quite openly. I believe that there is no way in the world any candidate for president of the United States could refuse to participate in a debate now. We're here talking now about 2011-2012 election year. There's just no way anybody. In the old days, it was easy. Incumbents, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, when it came time to run for re-election, they just said, no debates. And that was the end of it. But those days are gone.
Yeah. Actually, I wanted to ask you, Nixon said of his debate with Kennedy, quote, "I paid too much attention to what I was going to say and too little to how I would look." Is that a reality today?
Absolutely it is. Absolutely. There are examples after examples of candidates who did not heed Richard Nixon's words, and they paid a price for it. And you can argue, oh, that's terrible, because it should all be about words and substance. But there are two different kinds of words. There are the spoken words, and then there are the language words. And people take the measure of both. They hear and see both. And the body language is in some ways as important in some cases as the spoken language. And because people essentially in these presidential debates, vice presidential debates, remember, they come in the late fall. They're in late September, early October. By then, most of the people have already decided for whom they're going to vote or are leaning very strongly. About issues, they've pretty well resolved it. If you're in favor of lockboxes for Social Security, I'm with this person. Against it, I'm with it, whatever. But what remains, and why these debates are so important, is to take the measure of the individual, and you take it in all kinds of different ways. Yes, with the way they answer questions and all of that, but it's the way they handle themselves, and you think you kind of judge presidential temperament. You kind of people can't help it. Even if it's somebody you're opposed to, you know one of these people is going to be elected president, so you think, can I imagine this person sitting behind a desk in the Oval Office, making a decision about sending Americans into harm's way, reacting to another Katrina, reacting to another 9/11, all those kinds of things. And it's all about it's about the person as much as it is what his or her views might be.
Now, you mentioned town hall debates. I know some of my friends are saying, I don't want to see a town hall debate. I want the professionals to be asking the tough questions. What's your opinion about that?
Well, the way they operate, frankly, I pretty much say this in the book, the way these town hall formats are engineered and finessed and all of that, it has nothing to do with the public. They are, you can get 150, 200 people, they select questions, and any moderator knows there are only about 22 of them are going to be asked. So, and who selects those 22? The moderator. And so you have to, and when you came down in my case, and with any moderator's case, he's, okay, wait a minute, I've gone through the 22 best, I've picked the 22 of the best questions. Uh-oh, they can't all be left-handed, they can't be all from left-handed medium-sized white women or something like that. I mean, the gender thing, the race thing, the age, everything has to be covered. And so it's very, very tricky in picking those questions. And so it's artificial. It's no question it's artificial.
Seems like there's a lot of jockeying for position and where the debates are being held, from the Convocation Center in Miami to other parts of the country. How is that decided, actually?
Well, the debate commission, the moderator has nothing to do with that. Let me say that again. The moderator has nothing to do with where these things are held. But the debate commission does that, and they get essentially bids, I think. I mean, I think they apply, and they've put up some money. But basically, what a moderator is there to do is traffic cop and to react intelligently to what is being said, and not suddenly be. Oh, for instance, I tell a story in the book, and it's the thing example I use all the time. Let's say I'm interviewing somebody. I'm interviewing a senator, and I say, Senator, should we sell more grain to Cuba? Yes, Jim, I think we should sell more grain to Cuba. But before we do that, we should bomb Havana. And I say very quickly, what kind of grain, Senator? Because that was my next question.
Yes.
Those kinds of things, and you can, people who listen and watch radio or television interviews, they'll see that all the time, where some interviewer or moderator just didn't pick up on what was said. It was hugely important, and that's because they weren't relaxed enough.
And how long did it take you to prepare for a presidential debate?
Well, they're not all the same. Unfortunately, in most cases, journalists who are selected to do this kind of work have been covering the campaign all along. It isn't like they've just dropped out by parachute into moderate a presidential debate. So they've been covering the campaign. They know what the issues are, and but it's slightly different. For instance, the last one I moderated was 2008, John McCain, Barack Obama. The financial crisis had just hit, and I was supposed to do national security and foreign affairs. Well, because the financial crisis hit, it was agreed that the financial crisis fell into that category of national security. And so I started asking about the financial crisis, but I only had about 48 hours to kind of get it. And I was not an expert on the financial crisis, not an expert on the economy. Sure, I knew a lot about it. I've asked a lot of questions about it and all that. So I had to hit the books, so to speak. And I had to hit my comfort level at a rocket speed so I could listen to what these people were saying about the economy. And even that was in the early days of the economic thing, literally in the early days.
Well, of course, I have to ask you about the recent crop of Republican hopefuls and their debating on television. What are your comments?
Well, I think the if anybody ever doubted the importance of debates, all you have to do is think about what's happened with the Republican debates. The facts are obvious. Rick Perry, the perfect example. He announces and he skyrockets to the top of the polls. First debate, he doesn't do well, he drops. Michelle Bachmann, as the debates began, she was in the top tier. She didn't do very well the first debate, second debate, third debate, now she's single digits.
If called, would you consider moderating a 2012 debate?
No, ma'am. I've done that for my psyche and my country, and I wouldn't have written the book if I was still willing or thinking about it. I would accept another invitation to do debates. That's what I've done. I survived, and I'm proud of what I've done, and I'm honored to have been asked in the past. But enough's enough.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It's a wonderful book. Everyone should read it before this election.
Thank you, Elaine. Thank you.
From Jim Lehrer, the man widely hailed as the Dean of Moderators, comes Tension City, inside the presidential debates from Kennedy-Nixon to Obama-McCain. Lehrer presents and narrates a revealing book on 40 years of televised political debate. Lehrer gives listeners a ringside seat for epic political battles of our time, shedding light on all of the critical turning points and rhetorical faux pas that helped determine the outcome of presidential elections. Drawing on in-depth interviews with candidates and fellow moderators, Lehrer isolates and illuminates what he calls the major moments and killer questions that defined the debates. Who can forget Dan Quayle comparing himself to JFK? Barack Obama and John McCain barely making eye contact over the course of a 90-minute discussion. There are so many stories. You'll enjoy this riveting book from the man in the middle seat.
Also in Winston-Salem, my wife, Kate, helped with some much-needed pre-debate personal perspective that remains with me to this day. In the hotel, as we were leaving for the debate, I came down with a bad case of nerves. I whined to Kate about how terrible the pressure was on me. She said quite calmly, "If it's bad for you, think what it must be like for those two candidates. One bad move, and they lose the presidency of the United States." True. But I was still left with the pre-debate anxieties that have been with me in every one of the 10 presidential and vice presidential debates I have moderated since. I soon learned that dealing with nerves is the key to being able to function effectively as a moderator. My guess is that there are surgeons, classroom teachers, and short-order cooks among the huge crowds of other people who know exactly what I'm talking about. Possibilities of pleasure and satisfaction, horror and failure, await everyone who performs. The incredibly high stakes are what magnify it all in presidential debates. Candidates and their attendants have only one overriding purpose: to win the election, to be the most powerful person in the world. But others, including most in the serious press and political science worlds, see debates as decisive opportunities to inform and educate the voters about whom to grant such power. The critical space between those two very different purposes is the battleground on which all combat occurs.
Ugly. I don't like them.
That's how George H.W. Bush categorizes his debate experience.
Why not?
Well, partially I wasn't too good at them. Secondly, there's some of it's contrived, show business. You prompt to get the answers ahead of time. Now, this guy, you got Bernie Shaw on the panel, and here's what he's probably going to ask you. And you got Leslie Stahl over here, and she's known to go for this and that. And you got to remember, be sure I remember what Leslie's going to ask and get this answer. Now, that answer is not quite concise enough, so there's a certain artificiality to it, lack of spontaneity to it. And I don't know, I just felt uncomfortable about it.
That exchange was one of the many I had with the candidates after their presidential and vice presidential debates. The interviews, done over a period of 20 years, began as an oral history project with a commission on presidential debates. Portions were later used in Debating Our Destiny, a two-hour PBS documentary that was first broadcast in 2000. George W. Bush's view differed from his father's.
I think it's useful for people to watch and see how, a person they don't know stands up and answers questions and deals with the thrusts and parries of a debate. I also think that you can actually learn what the person believes during the debate, which is an important part of the process. No, I think they're very useful.
Ronald Reagan was also positive.
People have a right to know all they can in comparison to make a decision. But if the debate is concentrated then on the major issues and the views of the two individuals on those issues, then it is of service to the people.
Bill Clinton and Bob Dole, in their separate interviews, said debates help make for better candidates. "I think they force us to prepare," said Dole. "They force us to think about issues we maybe hadn't focused on. They force us to think ahead." Clinton went even further.
So even if these debates don't change many votes, and, you know, normally both sides will do well enough so they can avoid any lasting damage, having to do them and knowing that if you blow it, they will change a lot of votes, forces people who wish to be president to do things that they should do. And I am convinced that the debates that I went through, especially those three in 1992, actually helped me to be a better president.
George H.W. Bush, after further thought, favorably compared debates to competitive athletics, which he said he always loved. There was an adrenaline flow during debates similar to that triggered by sports, particularly tennis.
That was Tension City by Jim Lehrer.
Wait a minute. Is Glenn Beck comparing himself to George Washington? No, not really. Beck's new book, Being George Washington, is the story of a real-life superhero who possessed no special powers, yet changed the world. It's a story about a man whose life reads as if it were from the pages of an action novel. Bullet holes through his clothing, horses shot out from under him, unimaginable hardship, disease, heroism, spies, and double agents. And of course, the unmistakable hand of divine providence that guided it all. Through Beck's book, you'll not only learn history, but also see how the media and others have distorted our view of it. For all his heroism and triumphs, Washington's single greatest accomplishment was the man he created in the process, courageous and principled, fair and just, and, like all men, flawed. It's those flaws that must give us hope for today. The book is not only about being George Washington in 1776. It's about the struggle to be him every day of our lives. Understanding the way he turned himself from an uneducated farmer into the indispensable yet imperfect man, Glenn Beck seeks to lay out the path to build a new generation of George Washingtons who can take on the extraordinary challenges that America is once again facing. Ron McLarty narrates.
A blogger is typing furiously. He or she is sipping briskly from an 8-ounce can of lightly carbonated energy drink in an effort to stay awake just for a few more minutes to complete work on their newly discovered but soon to be mega controversy of the day. Glenn Beck thinks he's George Washington. He has a Washington complex. He's actually named his book Being George Washington. His ego's out of control. He must be threatening to start a revolution. I knew the Tea Party had to be dangerous. The news of my self-elevation to national fatherhood will likely spread from blog to blog, then to news sources and pundits, all of whom will be more than happy to spread the news that Glenn Beck's messianic complex can no longer be contained. None of them, of course, will take the time to realize the irony of the situation, that they are literally judging a book by its cover. So what's the truth? Simple. I do believe I'm George Washington, but I believe that you are as well. I don't believe this because I have an extraordinarily high opinion of myself. I believe it because I have a real understanding of who George Washington was. Contrary to popular belief, George Washington was not born a 555-foot, 5-inch monument. He was never a painting or a statue in a city. He was a man. Albeit one who happened to see his principles as immovable objects rather than minor inconveniences. That is what's truly inspiring about George Washington. He was a human, a capeless superhero. He faced many of the same challenges in life that we all face. Yes, he was given the responsibility to deal with historic challenges on a scope that is difficult for us to imagine today. But the reason he was given the enormous responsibilities is that people admired how he handled the small ones. He lived his life in a way that impressed and inspired others. So when the most trying times arrived, they all looked to him. Over and over again, he was willing to sacrifice his own happiness for the good of others. George Washington wound up at the top of every insurmountable mountain he came to because he never acknowledged that there was an insurmountable mountain in front of him. Sure, he knew the enormity of what he was facing, but he saw each decision as just another step, and he used his principles and his faith. Yes, sorry, critics. The man clearly believed God's hand was guiding him in America. he used that faith to constantly maintain sure footing. The Washington Monument really does tell his story, albeit unintentionally, as it towers above Washington, D.C. From a distance, it's a perfect structure. It owns the skyline. It's bigger than life itself in a city filled with people who think they're bigger than life itself. But as you walk up to the structure and view it up close, you can't help but notice all of the imperfections. In 1854, work on the project ground to a halt, and there was simply no more money left for the monument. Yes, I know, amazing as it seems, the government actually used to stop projects when they couldn't fund them. Anyway, when construction began again, the quarry that provided the stone for the first half of the monument could no longer be used because it had been exhausted building bunkers for the war. Today, if you stand close enough to the monument, you'll notice that it's two-toned. The marble granite stone used for the lower half is clearly a lighter or whiter shade than that that's used at the top. It is the monument that life and war got in the way of. But those imperfections serve as a perfect tribute to George Washington. He was that monument. From the distance of hundreds of years, he appears superhuman, able to soar heights that you and I cannot. In reality, however, his life was a series of challenges handled with honor, firmness, and faith, brick by brick. Many times he succeeded in facing those challenges, but sometimes he did not. Slavery is one frequently cited example. Yes, it is true, George Washington owned slaves. You can make all kinds of excuses for it. It was the norm at the time. He strongly advocated for the practice to be abolished. He treated his slaves well. He freed them upon his wife's death, etc., etc., etc.
That was Being George Washington by Glenn Beck. Back to Work, Why We Need Smart Government for a Strong Economy, President Bill Clinton gives us his views on today's challenges and why government matters. Clinton presents and narrates his ideas on restoring economic growth, energy, job creation, resolving the mortgage crisis, and financial responsibility. He offers a plan to, quote, get us back in the future business. Clinton explains how we got into this current economic crisis and lays down a plan for long-term prosperity. He also offers specific recommendations on how we can put people back to work, increase bank lending and corporate investment, double our exports, restore our manufacturing base, and create new businesses. He stresses the need for a strong private sector that works together with a smart government. Whenever we've given in to the temptation to blame government for all of our problems, we have lost our ability to produce sustained economic growth and shared prosperity. In the real world, Clinton writes, cooperation works better than conflict.
I want American dream growth. Lots of new businesses, well-paying jobs, and American leadership in new industries, like clean energy and biotechnology. Unless we restore robust economic growth, we'll be stuck in this economy for years, and nothing we do will solve the longer-term debt problem, regardless of how we try to do it. In short, we've got to get America back in the future business. Part 1, Where We Are. Chapter 1, Our 30-Year Anti-Government Obsession. I decided to write this book after the 2010 midterm election. Not because my party took a beating, but because of what the election was about. The bad economy, the high cost of keeping the recession from falling into full-scale depression, the fact that the recovery had not yet begun to improve many lives. All these ensured that anger and anxiety would be at high tide on election day, and that's always bad news for the party in power. What troubled me is that with so many people hurting and so many challenges to be faced, the election season offered few opportunities for a real discussion of what went wrong, what the president and Congress had actually done or failed to do in the previous 2 years, what the two parties proposed to do in 2011 and 2012, and what the likely consequences would be in the short and long runs. Nor was there much said of substance on the larger issues on which these questions would have an impact. How do we propose to restore and maintain the American dream at home? how do we ensure America's economic, political, and security leadership in the more competitive, complex, fragmented, and fast-changing world of the 21st century? Instead, the election seemed to occur in a parallel universe of inflated rhetoric and ferocious, but often inaccurate attacks that shed more heat than light. The Republicans seemed to be saying that the financial crash and the recession that followed, as well as the failure of the United States to fully recover from it less than 18 months after the economy bottomed out, were caused by too much government taxing, spending, and regulating, and that all would be well once we cut the cancer of government out of our lives and pocketbooks. They portrayed Democratic congressional incumbents and the president as big government liberals who brought America to the edge of destruction, and if given two more years, would push us over into the abyss. The attack proved to be very effective in the election, but I thought it was all wrong. First, the meltdown happened because banks were overleveraged, with too many risky investments, especially in subprime mortgages, and the securities and derivatives that were spun out of them, and too little cash to cover the risks. For example, Bear Stearns was leveraged at 35-1 when it failed. Traditionally, commercial bank lending is leveraged at 10 or 12-1, investment banking a bit more. In other words, there was not enough government oversight or restraint on excessive leverage. Second, the meltdown did not become a full-scale depression because the government acted to save the financial system from collapse. The Federal Reserve made massive investments of about $1.2 trillion to stop the financial collapse, including buying securities and guaranteeing loans. The often derided Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, was originally authorized to spend up to $700 billion and spent a bit over $400 billion. Most of the TARP money has been paid back, with only $104 billion still outstanding. In a July 8, 2011 Washington Post article, Alan Sloan and Doris Burke estimated that the final cost of the TARP program would be just $19 billion, and cited an analysis in Fortune magazine concluding that the Federal Reserve's income on its investments would actually produce a net profit for the taxpayers in the bailout of between $40 and $100 billion. Third, according to most economic studies, the stimulus, along with the rescue and restructuring of the auto industry, succeeded in keeping unemployment 1.5 to 2% lower than it would have been without it. Of course, the stimulus didn't restore the economy to normal levels. It wasn't designed to. You can't fill a several trillion-dollar hole in the economy with $800 billion. The stimulus was designed to put a floor under the collapse and begin the recovery. More than a third of the money funded a cut of about $800 per family in withholding taxes for 95% of American families, whose incomes had been increased modestly or not at all in the nearly 8 years before the crash.
That was Back to Work by President Bill Clinton. Bob Edwards hosted National Public Radio's Morning Edition for 24 and a half years. The show attracted more than 13 million listeners weekly. He joined NPR in 1974 and was co-host of the evening news magazine All Things Considered until 1979, when he helped launch the Morning Edition. Known for his sincerity, intelligence, and wit, Edwards helped build NPR's devoted audience. Bob is now host of The Bob Edwards Show on Sirius XM Radio and Bob Edwards Weekend, distributed to public radio stations. Both programs feature in-depth interviews with newsmakers, journalists, entertainers, and other compelling figures. Edwards was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and began his radio career there. Following service as a broadcaster with the American Forces Korea Network, Edwards moved to Washington, where he worked as an anchorman for WTOP, an all-news CBS affiliate. At age 25, he became a correspondent with the Mutual Broadcasting System. He is the author of several books, Fridays with Red, which chronicled his radio friendship with legendary sportscaster Red Barber, Edward R. Murrow and the Birth of Broadcast Journalism, and now, A Voice in the Box, My Life in Radio, a memoir that shapes a fascinating personal narrative from one of the most iconic personalities in radio history. The book recalls stories from his most memorable interviews, everything from Julia Child's declaration that she preferred quarter pounders to Big Macs, to Norman Mailer admitting he had just fired off a potboiler to pay the bills. Edward also addresses his departure from NPR with an honest, balanced assessment of what happened. Welcome, Bob. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Thanks for asking.
Radio is experiencing such a renaissance right now with rockers like Tom Petty, Bob Dylan hosting their own shows. How does radio keep inventing itself?
It has to. Everything keeps changing. It was supposed to die so many times when television came along, when newer technology came along, and we just become a part of it. You know, there's the internet one day. All right, well, we'll just be on the internet. And then iPhones come along. Oh, okay, we'll just incorporate radio into the iPhone. So we're there. We're there in both places. We'll be on your toaster if we're going to be transmitted that way. Whatever it takes, there'll be radio there.
Mm. All right, talking about your very incredible career, talk a little bit about the evolution from, of all things considered, from news program to magazine of the air.
Well, that is what it was supposed to be. That's what the original producers told us they wanted, a magazine of the air. I wasn't all that interested in a magazine of the air. I came from hard news. I came from, you know, the legacy of Edward R. Murrow. I was kind of a prig back then. And I think we kind of compromised. I think I became a lot looser than I was then, a lot more rigid, more open to new ideas, new ways of presenting stories on the radio. And they became much more of a news organization. It happened in pretty much in the 80s when radio was largely deregulated and commercial radio stopped doing news as a result because they didn't have to anymore. So people looking for radio on the, I mean, looking for news on the radio found public radio stations and NPR. And we just grew and grew as a news organization, and they're kind of out there by themselves now.
Waking up at 1 a.m. for 24 years, it took a very tough toll on you and your family. Would you do that again?
I don't think so. I think I did my time. I don't think we're meant to do that. I don't think biologically we are disposed to getting up at 1 o'clock in the morning. The tough part was going to sleep at 6 o'clock at night. My children would read me bedtime stories, which was odd, and then they got to stay up, and I, you know, what's wrong? Something wrong with them. Yes, it's very bad, and I don't think it was good for my health or anything else, but it was part of doing that program, and I love doing that program.
You say you've calculated that you've interviewed over 30,000 people in your career. That's an amazing achievement. How did you keep each one fresh and unique?
Well, it's you're doing it that day. I mean, even if you're talking to someone you've talked to multiple times before, it's that day and what's happening in their lives that day, what's happening in our country that day. So it was always fresh, particularly when I was doing a news program. I mean, today I'm doing long-form interviews. It's a different thing entirely. It's more of a conversation. It's more in-depth. You're able to tell multiple stories and go in a whole bunch of different directions. You're not just answering the pressing emergency of that day's news. I'm having a lot more fun now than I was back in those news days. This is a lot easier to do.
I've often wondered when you had to ask the really tough questions about scandals and breakups. I mean, how do you develop that tough skin that you need?
I know. Your mama didn't teach you to be that way. Your mama told you to be respectful and not bring up unpleasantness. And that's not what we do in this business. That's our job, to ask the tough questions, to ask the questions that the listener would ask if the listener were there in that chair talking to that person. So you have to. And I figured my guest understood that and would not be granting an interview with me unless they understood that and probably had prepared an answer. And so let's go on and do our business. It's my job to ask the question. It's the guest's job to answer it and mine to follow up when I don't like that answer.
I know that there must have been several times when you've been in an interview and you knew that it was making for really bad radio. What do you do in a case like that?
Well, hopefully you're not live in that case. Yeah, I've had those. I had Andy Warhol, who was in something of a coma. Don't know what he had ingested that day, but I was getting...
Oh, really? I did?
And that was when I could get anything out of him at all. Fortunately, that was taped. or in our case, destroyed. But you don't want something like that happening live. So. Andy would have been bad live, I think.
You've written that politicians are kind of the worst group to interview. Why?
Because they're stuck on the message of the day, and they don't want to leave it. They're scared to death that you're going to get them off guard, and they're going to say something that's going to create problems for them. But I try to disarm them, get them to tell me a personal story about themselves or something, and maybe I can ease them into another area if they're off guard that way. But mostly they're boring and are trying to, you know, fry their fish, and they don't care what you are asking them about at all. So I much prefer writers, musicians, creative people talking about the creative process and expressing themselves in wonderful ways that entertain us.
Is it your opinion that politicians today are so handled and so well rehearsed that you really can't get through to the core of what they truly believe in, just kind of their spiel?
Well, if that were true, then Herman Cain wouldn't be at a microphone.
Touche.
How polished is that? Huh?
How different is it working for satellite radio?
I don't think it's the medium that matters so much. It's different in that I don't have member stations as I did with public radio, although I also still do a public radio program, so I'm in both worlds. But I don't get to talk to my satellite listeners the way I do. I don't get to go out and meet them, is what I'm saying, because we don't have stations in satellite radio, so that's kind of weird.
What do you see as the prognosis for public radio?
I love public radio. I think it's a national treasure. I think it's more important than ever, given the shrillness of talk radio and media becoming more partisan, newspapers in deep trouble and dying off. I think public radio fills a role that's very important, particularly in news, as people struggle to have enough information to make sound decisions in voting, and you know, it's their role in our democracy. So long may it thrive, and I hope public support continues for it, and I think it should.
Your book, A Voice in the Box, it's very compelling reading. How did you decide actually what to put in there over your very, very incredible career?
I just picked the highlights, what people, you know, obviously they're not interested in the minutia of my childhood or anything like that, but certain things formed me, and I thought they were important, and I included them. I guess I left out some personal embarrassments. I think every author, if he's honest, but nothing that, you know, is really of importance to the reader. But, you know, I think I'm very honest about some things. My shortcomings as a broadcaster, things I learned the hard way in radio, not prejudices, but obstacles to my development that I had to overcome and learn to accept. And where I was wrong at NPR and where they were right, and when they were wrong and when I was right. I think I was pretty honest and straight up about all of that.
Well, thank you so much for stopping by. The book, A Voice in the Box, is a wonderful, interesting story of your life and an entire industry.
Well, thank you very much. I hope so. I hope it's, you know, people understand it's more than just about me, about things that have gone on in the world and particularly in the media for the last 43 years. So I hope people find something good there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. In Five Chiefs, a Supreme Court memoir, Justice John Paul Stevens captures the inner workings of the Supreme Court via his personal experiences with five former chief justices: Fred Vinson, Earl Warren, Warren Burger, William Rehnquist, and John Roberts. Stevens was a law clerk during Vinson's tenure, a practicing lawyer for Warren, a circuit judge and junior justice for Burger, a contemporary colleague of Rehnquist's, and a colleague of current Chief Justice John Roberts. Along the way, he discusses his views of some of the most significant cases decided by the court. Packed with interesting anecdotes and stories about the court, Five Chiefs, narrated by Gregory Itzen, is an unprecedented and historically significant look at the highest court in the land.
Over the years following my graduation from Northwestern in 1947, I had personal contact not only with Vinson, but also with his four successors, Earl Warren, Warren Burger, William Rehnquist, and the court's current leader, Chief Justice John Roberts. My objective in recording this book is to share memories of these men and their work that may enable listeners to receive insights similar to those that Nat conveyed to me 6.5 decades ago. I do not intend to provide a comprehensive review of their jurisprudence or tenures. Instead, I hope that my recollections will improve public understanding of their work and the office that they each occupied with honor and varying degrees of expertise. The Chief Justice of the United States has often been described as the first among equals. He is equal because, like each of his 8 colleagues, he has only one vote. It takes a majority of equally powerful votes to support a decision on the merits in any case before the court. To achieve a desired outcome, the Chief Justice must convince as many colleagues to join him as must any other justice. For that reason, as Byron White, who served as an active justice for 31 years, frequently observed, the confirmation of any new justice creates a new court with significantly different dynamics than its predecessor. One could argue that 2010, when Elena Kagan joined the court as its 112th justice, marked the inauguration of the Kagan Court rather than the continuation of the Roberts Court. If so, the court that Lewis Powell and Bill Rehnquist joined in 1972 would be better termed the Powell-Rehnquist Court than the Burger Court. But naming conventions are otherwise. Historians treat the story of our nation's more than 100 different courts as though it contained just 17 chapters, each named after the Chief Justice whose tenure it tracks. In these memoirs, I shall therefore include separate chapters discussing each of the 5 courts during which I had some personal contact with the Chief Justice. Because the entire history of the court includes only 17 chapters, I begin with a brief review of the first 12 of those chapters. A full account of the tenure of each of the first 12 individuals who have presided over the court could fill 12 books, but I will limit myself to a quick glimpse of each. I will then describe the unique duties of the officer whom Congress has described as the Chief Justice of the United States. And, having served as the Senior Associate Justice during my last 15 years on the court, I shall close with a few comments on the role of the person who might be dubbed the second among equals. Because I shall refer to different provisions of the Constitution so frequently, I have included the entire text of that document in the PDF included with this program. My reminiscences about Fred Vinson, Earl Warren, Warren Burger, Bill Rehnquist, and John Roberts make up the body of the book. For each of them, my memories primarily reflect a different point of view. That of another justice's law clerk for Vinson, of a practicing lawyer for Warren, of a circuit judge and junior justice for Burger, of a contemporary colleague for Rehnquist, and of an observer of superb advocacy before Roberts became a colleague. Because of those differing points of view, some autobiographical comments must be tolerated. Chapter 1. The First 12 Chiefs. Article 3 of the Constitution provides that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as Congress shall from time to time ordain and establish. In 1789, Congress enacted the First Judiciary Act, which formally created a Supreme Court, composed of 6 judges and a network of inferior courts.
That was 5 Chiefs by Justice John Paul Stevens. Every day, President Obama reads 10 representative letters among thousands received from citizens across the land. The letters come from people of all ages, walks of life, and political points of view. Some are heartbreaking, some angry, some hopeful. Indeed, Obama reads as many letters addressed to Dear Jackass as Dear Mr. President. Eli Saslow, a rising star at the Washington Post, became fascinated by the power of these letters and set out to find the stories behind them in 10 Letters, The Stories Americans Tell Their President. Through the lens of 10 letters to which Obama responds personally, this relevant and poignant book explores those individual stories, taking an in-depth look at the misfortunes, needs, opinions, and anger over the current state of the country that inspired 10 people to put pen to paper. Surprisingly, what also emerges from these narratives is a story about the astounding endurance and optimism of the American people.
Like all presidents, he described his responsibilities as never-ending, and his aides conceded that they had underestimated the range of issues Obama would face during his first term. He had flown 152 times on Air Force One in the last year, visiting 30 states and 21 countries. He had given 160 news interviews, delivered 412 speeches, and spoken at 5 funerals. He had committed to a war in Afghanistan and received the Nobel Peace Prize. On an average day, he squeezed in a morning workout after his daughters left for school, rushed to a national security meeting at 8:30 a.m., and continued working virtually uninterrupted until nearly midnight. He usually spent the last 2 hours of his workday on a couch at home, where he fought off sleep and read the briefing book. Now he opened the purple folder and glanced at the cover sheet. "Memorandum to the President," it read. "Per your request, we have attached 10 pieces of unvetted correspondence addressed to you." Inside, Obama found crumpled notebook paper, smudged ink, sloppy handwriting, and misspelled words, a collection of 10 letters from constituents that he considered his most important daily reading. One letter was from a grade schooler asking for help on his spelling homework. Another was from an unemployed mother demanding a job. Depending on the nature of each letter, Obama sometimes copied them for senior advisors, distributed them to members of his cabinet, or read parts aloud to his wife before bed. He had first requested a sampling of 10 letters on his second day as president, and the purple folder had come 6 days a week ever since, couriered to Obama even when he was away at Camp David or traveling abroad. The White House mail staff sorted through 20,000 letters and emails addressed to Obama every day, screening for security threats, categorizing by topic, and then picking the most representative 10 pieces for the purple folder. The letters chosen each day were the most intimate connection Obama had left to the people he governed. He believed the wide-ranging feedback, quick emails and thoughtful letters, congratulations and condemnations, offered him a unique view beyond the presidential bubble into what he called the real America, a place of uncensored opinion. "I will tell you," Obama had said, laughing, "my staff is very even-handed, because about half of these letters call me an idiot." He loved the give and take, aide said. He always read all 10 letters and typically wrote back to 1 or 2 writers each day, usually responding by hand to those who offered articulate criticism or moving stories of hardship. Obama often said that the letters not only reminded him of why he had run for president, they also reminded him of all the work he had left to do. But lately, the tenor of the letters had changed, becoming darker. There were fewer glowing post-inauguration thank yous and more missives addressed to Dear Jackass, Dear Moron, or Dear Socialist.
That was 10 Letters, The Stories Americans Tell Their President by Eli Saslow.
readers, my campaign promise is to always bring you titles making headlines across our great nation. And a quick check of my website, bookreportradio.com, will help you keep current on which books get your vote for your literary agenda. Thanks so much for joining me today. See you back here next week on The Book Report. Now it's much too late, 'cause it's a fine